from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper, you are Live from the Path.
And you're listening to Live from the Path. We're coming from the Pathway Studios here in Johnston proper. It's a wet Monday. I don't even know.
What?
Maybe it's not wet where you're not. It's a wet Monday.
It is wet.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it is.
What? Why are you picking a fight with me?
It's a weird
it's
adjective.
It's wet outside.
Hey, man, it's a great Monday.
Would you prefer moist?
Sure.
Okay.
Moist works for me.
A lot of people are freaked out by that word.
I feel awkward saying moist Monday.
That's true. No,
yeah, why is that?
I have many friends who hate the word moist. Like,
why?
Are completely against it. And I have, for that reason alone, I use the word moist as much as I can around
I think now. Of a chocolate cake.
Right. I think of something delicious. It's moist.
Or an uncomfortable itch.
Or a damp towelette. This is a mistake. All right. Hey, you're listening live from the past. Here's what I got going on the show this week. This week's show is designed to not make me a liar. Because what keeps happening is I keep saying, we're going to talk about X, Y, and Z, and then I want to talk about P, Q, and W, and I never get to X, Y, and Z. And that's happened for the past 3 weeks. So here, we're going to try to Ben's not a liar week here on Life in the Path. We got some articles we need to hit. The first one is, this is the worst offender ever. Which is what not to say to someone who's been hurt by church. I think this one's 3 weeks out. I promise you it's been up on my screen to talk about it. We've been talking about other things. Boova double barrel Pope styled me, and then I got completely distracted last week. So
I'm sorry, that was my fault.
So we're going to hit, there's a this is from Relevant Magazine. There's a forlorn witty lady in a double-breasted coat looking down. Next to, I don't know where she's got by this log cabin. Anyway, she's been hurt by the church, and we need to figure out what we've done to cause her to stand out in the woods.
I'm going
to
guess I say every one of them.
You think, Dad, you're responsible
having
for
having not read
of these?
The article, I'm just going to guess. I'm just going to, yeah.
That sounds viable. That
You've
sounds
had 3 weeks to read the article, man.
That was a, yeah, I need more time.
Fair enough. Dan, I know you're a busy man, and I appreciate that.
Something said to someone who has been hurt by the church. No, I didn't read your article. Love, Dan.
But how dare you, church? Don't hurt me.
So we're going to get to that. Also, modesty, that word does not mean what you think it means. And we'll talk a little bit about that. The last time we had a modesty conversation, I want to say it was like 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a
while. I think it's been a long time.
It's been a very long while.
So we're going to see if we've matured on this topic. and then we'll go from there. Also, there was an article at Relevant Magazine called "We're Called to Make Disciples, Not Converts," and I think generally we can that's just broadly agreeable. But I want to talk about kind of the guts of the article and see if we can dig on that vibe there. Big heads up, by the way. Over the next couple of weeks, we got a couple of excellent musical acts coming in. Foreverland's going to be in next Monday. That's at 10 o'clock. They're going to be in studio performing some tunes, talking about their new album. And the following Monday, Josh Crawford is going to be here. And it sounds like high potential that Silverside might be able to swing back in sometime mid-July.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, so over the next few weeks, got tons of sweet musical talents sweeping on a Life from the Past. So set the alarm clocks, boys. Take an afternoon nap if you have to, but hang out for that live program. Both next week is Forever Lynn. The week after is Josh Crawford. It's somewhere mid-July. We're probably looking at Silverside. So exciting stuff going on. All right, before I derail the show, let's talk about this this promised article, What Not to Say by Someone... What not to say to someone who has been hurt by church. 6 misguided responses to spiritual abuse. Period. A few years ago, I had my first experience with spiritual abuse. Compelled to... Wait a minute. Didn't we read this guy? No. It's the same guy, though.
It's the same guy, but it's a different...
It's the same guy.
Yeah, it's a different article.
It's a repackaged article.
I thought this was our missionary friend who ended up in a rough times overseas and couldn't get his way out of it.
Apparently, that just didn't do it. You couldn't just write one article about it.
No. Yeah, things are holding on. He's forlorn in his picture. All right, here we go. Compared to serve God in a radical way, I dropped out of college, gave away all my possessions, and moved to Africa, only to be manipulated, controlled, and taken advantage of by the leaders in the mission organization. Okay, we talked about that. When I got home, my pastor gave me 2 options. I could either lie and make up a nicer-sounding story, or I could just keep my mouth shut. Either way, I was forbidden from telling the real story inside or outside the church. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It's one thing to be abused by people you barely know, but it's another thing to be betrayed by someone you trusted and looked up to. That's a weird distinction for me. I don't know that I've ever said, it's one thing to be abused by people you barely know. I feel like that's still awkward. Anyway, I was angry and depressed.
Yeah, just don't be abused.
Yeah. And I fell away from church for the first time in my life. Thankfully, some of my friends understood what I was going through. Others, not so much. Many of the responses I've witnessed firsthand. In the past, I've even been guilty of saying a few of these myself. Here are a few things not to say to someone who has been hurt by their church. All right, here we go. Dan, we're going to see how guilty Dan is on
all
this
right,
one.
All right,
number one, no church is perfect. Instead of
ding, 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 ding.
score one, Dan.
Instead of empathizing with those who have been hurt by a church, some Christians go right into defense mode. They might argue that the victim just had a bad experience, or they'll say the church is full of imperfect people who are only human and make mistakes just like the rest of us.
I don't know if that's defense mode. That's just being here's the deal. No church is perfect. I mean, lower your expectations.
Okay.
All right. But
is it outrageous so far?
A little bit, because you've switched the discussion from the person to the entity that abused them and hurt them.
Okay.
And really the person needs the sympathy. They need the connection first.
Okay.
We don't know that side of the story, though.
Right.
He's in a bad spot, because he's been told, don't tell the story.
Right.
Of course,
he has
to the world, and even on Life in the Path, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
But
which is huge.
So, exactly. We're on the World Wide Web. And so the person who's coming to him doesn't know that side of the story. They're thinking, oh, someone took his parking spot, and he's upset.
Right.
And it's like, well, no, really, no church is perfect. Okay. I'm defending the average person who would say maybe something like that, potentially.
So here's where he continues to justify this. He says, but can we agree that these excuses only distract from the problem? No one wants to be told to focus on all the good things the church does when they've been hurt by one. It doesn't matter how many thousands of people have been positively affected by a church or ministry, the good experiences don't cancel out the bad ones.
So I think, was that the end of his argument?
That's it, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
From what I can tell is if that's all you said, yeah, that's a problem. Like if your entire statement to that person who's been hurt is, oh, the church isn't perfect, it's full of imperfect people, just don't worry about it. Yeah, that's a problem. It's awful. This person has been hurt by the church that they believe in and they love. Dave, I think you're right. I mean, when it comes to we have to be sympathetic to that person and empathetic to that person and understand that they've been hurt. If your only statement to that person is, oh, it's okay, nobody's perfect, I hope that helps. And
yeah,
that's
you need
it.
To ask about the story.
Yeah, exactly. That's not
those
genuine
were both
human
sets
connection.
Of really poor leaders.
Right, exactly.
They were not representing Jesus.
That's not genuine human connection. That's not trying to be with somebody and help them out. That's just going, oh, defense mode, excuse, and then being done with it. So if that's all that you said, that's a problem. But I don't feel that in and of itself is a bad statement.
Yeah, it's a weird microcosm that they've presented here. Because the truth is it's agreed that where you've been hurt, if you don't deal with the underlying thing that's happened, the thing that's caused them hurt, and at least provide some validation that, like, I understand you were hurt. Anything you have to say after that is going to feel irrelevant.
Right.
Because that's the truth you didn't actually talk about the thing that matters to them, and that's treating them not like a human, but a simple circumstance in which you can flip and do facts and just say, now you should be different. Like, that's not humanity.
And he's projecting too much on himself, though. This isn't really about him. This is about poor leadership. These guys did not have integrity.
Well, yeah, right. That's
particular
story.
And he's making it, whoa, me, they abused me. It's like, those guys need out, they need out of leadership.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I suppose, though, the truth is, the thing that he's saying not to say, I wouldn't agree that those aren't things to say.
Right.
It's just, they exist in the right time and in the right perspective.
Yeah.
And so, like, if that's what you're opening with, I mean, the no, I think that's false, right? But the truth is, if someone says, here, this thing happened to me, and now I'm done with the church, how is that not the right context? Yeah, that isn't the only thing that happens in the church. Like, so, deal with it in the right order and in the right time. But I think it's probably a false dichotomy to say, you either say these things or you don't say them, because otherwise it might harm somebody. It's just, does it sit in the right perspective?
It's a weird statement to say. I mean, you wouldn't expect to go into like a customer service department or a customer resolution place at Target or somewhere and expect them to say, hey, well, no department store is perfect. I mean,
right.
No one comes in with that expectation, but somehow because we know that we're an entity that God's involved in, people have a different kind of expectation when it comes to this. And so for some reason, we feel a need to have to say, hey, God's perfect, not us. Well, yes, that is a true statement, but
not entirely relevant to the discussion.
Well, I think that depends on perspective. Like, as an example, like, I've done customer service stuff, and you'll have people say, you guys screw this up all the time. I say, actually, we screwed up this one thing, and we've caused you definite problems here. Nothing else, though.
Right.
Because it's a perspective issue. It's not it's not invalidating the truth that this guy's been harmed, right? But, like, if you're on a ledge that says this happens all the time and you're simply wrong about that, like, you're working off a false perspective. And I don't know that it's helpful to try to validate the fact and tell you that it's all right to be working from a false perspective. But, like, the question is in what way and in what position you are to do such a thing, right? It is, if someone says, oh, I've been hurt by the church, we're like, well, it's not like that everywhere. That's a complete ignorance of their circumstance. It's not treating them like a human, and not dealing with the fact that they were a real person that was really hurt by, intentionally or not, a church that's done something. Like, as you ignore that, yeah, I think that's treating them poorly. But if their perspective is that, like, I was treated this way, I'm done with the church, I don't know that those other parts aren't relevant for a proper perspective.
Yeah, in my experience, usually when that statement is, you know, when I would use a statement like that, hey, the church isn't perfect, it truly is a minor offense. It's not like they have abused, like, this guy was abused. He really was. Mm-hmm. Well, he was in an abusive situation. You know, usually it's like someone, it's a relationship issue. You know, hey, someone said I'm not a very good mom, and now I'm mad, and that happens all the time. It's like, well, you right, like you said there. It's like, well, no, everybody doesn't come up to you and say you're a bad mom. That one person does, and they say that to everybody, and they're an imperfect person, and we're trying to help them with that. The church is imperfect.
You
can't use that to blow off big stuff, though.
That's the thing, because the tagline, the quote that's next to it says, if you're more concerned about the church's reputation than you are about the abuse itself, you might have your priorities mixed up.
Yeah.
I would agree with that,
yeah.
But I don't think I would never say that out of trying to maintain the church's reputation.
No.
I would only say that because we're trying to maintain a hold on truth.
Exactly.
What is your actual reality? Now, if you do all those things, if your goal is to get past this conversation and say and try to convince someone that they weren't harmed or not validate the fact that they were harmed, that's poor. But, like, in trying to actually take a grasp of their reality, I'm struggling with why some of that isn't relevant to that right perspective. Mm-hmm. So, all right, that was number one.
Used it.
Oh boy, here we go. Number two, are you working toward reconciliation? The last thing a victim of spiritual abuse needs to do is go right back into the environment that hurt them in the first place. If someone has been attacked by a dog, would you tell them to go back and risk getting bit again?
Depends on the dog.
At some point, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Can't hide from dogs
your whole
life. I'm
going to avoid that neighborhood forever.
Hold on, let it play out. Christians who insist on reconciliation in the face of spiritual abuse are forgetting one important thing. Abusive people can't always be reasoned with. Agreed.
Yeah.
Not only is it dangerous to ask a victim to make amends with their abusers, it also puts an undue burden of responsibility on the victim to come up with a solution. It's like saying they're the ones who hurt you, but now it's your job to make it right. Okay, basic premise, yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that. It kind of depends on the issue, too, I guess.
I think it depends on what you mean by resolution.
Okay, go ahead.
Seeking resolution. Because if you're trying to go back to and turn a very awkward relationship into something that it really shouldn't be, then you're just putting too many expectations on it. You can't make it perfect just by your own sheer willpower.
Yeah.
And obviously I can't just send you back into a relationship and pretend that you can fix the other person. That's just ridiculous. But sometimes the resolution might just end up with, hey, you know, do the best you can, make peace and move on. You do what you can to make peace with the person, with the situation,
yeah.
But you got to move on. And what's going to get you to healthy?
I think that would have to be in the context in a church leadership sense of making sure there's repentance on the other person's part too. Like, he's coming from a part of the leaders are like, no, we're right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
We need to be quiet about it. Well, you can't reconcile with that. I mean, they're not acknowledging the fact that they are being sinful.
Right.
I mean, there's a sinful situation.
Yeah. I'm more likely to use the phrase, are you working toward forgiveness?
Yeah.
Than
yeah.
I am, are you working towards reconciliation? Because that's something that is within your control.
Yeah. In that case, they need to be in a different community of believers.
Yeah. I think that this is another one that I'm going to say that in the right context, this is okay to be talking about. Now, if someone has just come to you and talked about this abuse and this is the first conversation that you've had and your immediate statement is, well, are you working towards reconciliation? Yeah. What robot are you that you don't know how to speak to humans? Like, I don't understand where that's coming from if that's your first thing out of your mouth. Yes, that's awkward, that's uncomfortable, and that's incorrect. You shouldn't be doing that. Now, is that to say that this is not a conversation you should have eventually? No, you should. This is something that's good. You should be working towards. Yeah, I think we could change the word reconciliation to forgiveness. I agree with that. And it's a fair statement. You know, what are you doing to make sure that this is a forgiveness thing, that it's not an anger issue on your heart? You know that you're called to forgive things like this, and you know that you're called to understand that people are inhuman, or people are human and are going to screw up. How are you making sure that this is not something you're holding on to in your heart and being bitter about? However, that doesn't mean that that's the first thing you say. So I don't think I would agree with the premise of you should never say this to someone who's been, you know, in an abusive situation with the church leadership, with the church in general. But I don't think it's something that you should completely cut out of all of your conversations and never talk about.
Yeah. Is this list, does it have to be spiritual abuse? Like, does this not, this seems to fit like general relationship.
I think it fits general
issues,
relationships,
right?
As well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And the same is stated. I mean, the same works. If that's your first thing out of your mouth, if someone says to you, you know, I'm in an abusive relationship, well, are you working towards forgiveness? It's like, yeah, that's a really weird thing to say, and that's uncomfortable in human conversation. You didn't care about their situation. You didn't empathize or sympathize with them at all. And all you're talking about is the end result before working through the path that you need to get there.
Yeah, and I think the root of where this is a problem, when you say, are you working toward reconciliation, is it takes something where someone has sought assistance with the community, and we said no, you deal with individual things,
right?
Like where we said where a community should be there to otherwise support you and love you and care for you and help you in some of these things. If our reaction is did you handle this, then we'd failed as a community. So I'm not disagreeing. I think with the base premise, it's just I think to act like it doesn't have a place. It's just a step early. Actually, kind of like the first one was. You're just a step early,
right?
Okay. All right. Number three, I don't want to gossip. If a pastor or staff member is mistreating someone in the congregation, it's not gossip for that person to talk about it. In fact, it's not even gossip for you to talk about it. Imagine if you found out your brother-in-law was beating your sister. Yikes. Would your first response be, that's none of my business? The same way domestic abuse involves a whole family, spiritual abuse involves a whole church family. The abuse may have taken place in private, but that doesn't make it a private matter. As Christians, if we're going to start taking spiritual abuse seriously, we need to stop comparing it to gossip. All right, so fellas, help me understand here. So understand, we got this guy's background a little bit. What are some other examples of spiritual abuse that this might be referring to, so I can have this kind of live in the right context here? Because I'm trying to think what he's getting at.
Right.
There's lots of little personality conflicts that lead to little skirmishes in the parking lot. Not skirmish, like a fist fight, but I mean, like, you know, they took my parking spot, they sit in my pew, I was supposed to serve communion this week and they did it, or, you know, whatever silly things that I would look at and say they're kind of silly, but they mean something to those people, mostly because they're based on a sour relationship in the first place. It's kind of a symptom of kind of a cesspool relationship going on.
So that's abuse.
Well, so no. It feels like the person who wrote the article is saying that the abuse in and of itself was a wrong was done. And then the church shooed it away like nothing had happened.
Yeah.
I don't know if that qualifies for spiritual abuse. I wouldn't say it does. I think that it's just a problem has happened within the leadership or within, you know, the community that you're in, where something was done to you and you felt wronged and you were not.
Because the article's not about abuse. That's just this dude's history. He's just like, anybody who is upset with the church, you're not supposed to say this, right?
Well, so I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, how do I know? Like, besides his circumstance, what's an example of spiritual abuse of which this might seem to be like? Because, like, I think that what you're saying, Dan, are people who I'd be like, you feel like you've been harmed, and I would say you're probably acting petty, as opposed to someone who is like, real, like, the church does this. It does happen to people, but in what way? Like, what otherwise would qualify as a spiritual abuse of which these things are applicable?
I mean, like, I've been in situations where, like, say, a vacation Bible school staff. And someone was going to lead this ministry for a year who was really great with children but terrible with adults. I mean, explosively terrible. And so, like, I kind of jumped in and said, you know, you're probably not the person to lead this ministry because the leader of this works with adults, not children.
Yeah.
And that became a very explosive issue. You abused me. You're terrible. I can't believe you're so mean to me, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, I'm not trying to save you and this ministry is going to happen to children. I because then I have an outside eyes that can look at it and say, that's just not your gift set.
Yeah.
they would call that abuse, though. Or, you know, me and I'm leaving.
I think you're looking at a scenario where somehow trust is given and trust is violated. So someone's made themselves vulnerable to something. But I'm still speaking in generalities because I don't know any firsthand really good examples.
Right. I'm trying to think of...
That seems like a good definition, right? Like there is a leadership in your church. You were to you shared something with them, and they shared it with other people, and then acted like they didn't. Like, I mean, there's definitely sin involved on the other side of it, I guess.
Right.
Okay. Maybe we don't have to have another
spectrum though. This, like, I've talked to people who have left a church saying, "Well, so and so is a leader in the church, and I see how they live on the side. I heard them swear." When they hit, you know, their mechanic and they hit their arm, their fist, you know, it slipped. I see the way they talk to women or the way they treat, you know, they'll look at some other person and say, I can't be around these hypocrites because, you know, I just can't do this. I'm going to leave the church and I can be a hypocrite on my own. And that's where it'll be like, well, the church is full of imperfect people. We're all in this process of reconciliation with God and you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thought it would provide a different perspective and help us to understand these different outside of that guy's own circumstances.
Yeah, because this is a big deal. His is big.
Yeah. I don't want to reduce that. It seems like maybe at least in the room, our experiences tend to either be things where people, I don't know, had the perspective of abuse and it probably was a little exaggerated or greatly exaggerated. So we just don't have a tangible firsthand account of seeing these things. So it's difficult to process them within the scope of which I think he's talking about. All right, let's keep getting through them though. So anyway, I don't say I don't want to gossip. Agreed.
So the point is they don't want to talk about it because they don't want to gossip.
So like if someone says I've been abused by the church and you say,
oh, don't tell me.
Because I don't want to gossip.
Yeah,
oh, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you're being I don't know why you're being so passive about something that's it's someone is hurt.
Unless you're someone who has no ability to do anything about anything. I mean, if you're a Joe Church Pew guy talking to Joe Church Pew guy and they're just doing it to rant.
Agree, but at the same point in time, you're in a position to help your fellow, you know, believer.
If you would engage and do so, but if you like you have
if your thought process after someone comes to you with this is going to be like, well, I'm not going to do anything for you, and I'm not going to care about you in any way.
Yeah.
So don't worry. Don't tell me because I don't want to gossip. That's a really passive way to put it. But if you're coming from the perspective, even if you're a Joe Pugh guy, if you're Joe Pugh guy that's been brought this to you by another person, you know, try and counsel that person to get the right help.
Yeah.
I don't want to gossip is the wrong way to do it. Saying to that person, you know, George. I'm sorry that all happened to you. I don't personally know what's going on, and I wasn't involved in that. You know, maybe we should go talk to the person that would be able to help you out. Maybe we can go.
Maybe we should reconcile.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been seeking reconciliation, Joe?
I think it's. I don't think you have to. I mean, sometimes you're helping them by simply being there,
right,
and listening to them. So, like, I don't know that you have to be the one that can actually do anything about whatever the situation is. But like, you are providing support to someone by listening to their story. I think that's
all
right.
It's only gossip if you keep it continuing the story, too.
Well, yeah.
That's true.
You keep it quiet, it
if you're listening ear and then a speaking mouth afterwards, that's a problem.
Gossip is not, it's not an, it's not that information was passed.
I can't listen to your problems, it's gossip.
Yeah, it's the state of your heart as you take it in and then pass it around.
Yeah. Oh, I heard so-and-so.
Yeah, that's dumb. That's dumb.
Yeah, so you have the power whether that's gossip or not.
Yeah, that's like saying I don't want any sin to occur here by listening to your story as sin occurs as part of your story. That's dumb.
Don't tell me about someone else's sin. It's a problem.
I agree. As Christians, if we're going to start taking spiritual abuse seriously, we need to stop comparing it to gossip. Agreed, but that's true with a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
Like
that'd be like the transmission of information could be grounds for lying, so I don't want to hear anything from you.
Yeah. Who wants to take the risk?
Yeah, you could possibly be lying to me, and if I say it, I could possibly be lying to someone else, so I don't want to talk.
Stop speaking.
I stop speaking, and I will stop listening entirely.
All right, number four. Have you ever, what are non-believers going to think?
Who cares?
What?
Go ahead.
Have you ever read a headline about a Christian going public against a church or ministry and thought to yourself, is this providing a good witness? I don't speak like that. If you're more concerned about the church's reputation than you are about the abuse itself, you might have your priorities mixed up. As Christians, we can get so preoccupied with how outsiders view the church that we put appearances before the truth. When we try to control the narrative, we substitute the reality of the church for our own ideal of the church. All we're showing the world is that we prefer a false witness over a bad one.
There's an interesting issue in the middle of that, the substituting the reality of the church for, what was it he said? Your ideal of the church for the reality of the church.
Yeah, we substitute the reality of the church for our own ideal of the church.
Oh. Fellas, am I weird for, yes. for yes. Yeah, okay, fair yeah. enough. I don't really ever concern myself with what non-believers think of the church.
I don't.
Like, I don't think to myself, oh, man, insert pastor name here that has done something wrong. What are all the non-believers going to think about the body of Christ? I've never once found myself thinking that because that's not something I can affect. Like, I'm not going to be able to go be PR for Jesus and then make sure that I have controlled every possible thing that any non-believer ever hears about the church or about God. Like, I don't ever think that way. Is that a problem, or am I okay with that?
You're okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would much rather worry about my own influence on the people around me and thinking about how can I affect the people that are in my actual areas of influence.
Why
and
portray talk to them. A fake perfection?
Right. Exactly. Like, I feel like some of the biggest, we'll use the word, the strongest witness, is where Jesus works in imperfection.
Yeah.
And he helps to perfect imperfection. If everybody was perfect and the body of Christ was perfect and the church was perfect, we don't really need him.
Yeah.
There's not too much room for Jesus to work if we're already great.
This is convicting. I guess I made a phone call a few weeks ago and I said, Creflo, I said, is this providing a good witness? And he didn't respond. He got on his plane and left. And
no response.
I felt awkward about it ever since because I thought, what are non-believers going to think about this?
Yeah, okay, so to actually hit the situation here with the article that's calling for, if someone said to you after you told them about how you were, in your mind, abused by the church, and they said to you, what are non-believers going to think? Walk away from them.
Yeah, that's weird.
They don't know how to speak to humans, and they don't know how to be human. They're dehumanizing you by their existence.
Yeah,
walk away.
Actually, it's just a broad note is like, God doesn't need us to control his PR.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the thing under control. Like, he's left a full record of what it is the world is to know about him.
Don't tell anybody King David had an affair.
Yeah. Hey, don't tell him about that one story where that one, you know, there's murder in the Bible. Don't talk about that one.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the tenets of our show is the honest faith part is very different than what you find in a lot of expressions of Christianity where they're trying to fake it till they make it.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
I don't want
to
be.
Hey God, I know you're super. I know you're super powerful, and I believe in you wholeheartedly to be the master of the universe. But I'm going to go ahead and tweak a little bit of that, just because I think it's going to work a little bit better for non-believers. I'm not going to talk about, you know, the imperfection of the church that's going to be bad. We're not going to look into that because you never know what non-believers are reading nowadays. It's like where do you come off as thinking that you're the one who needs to control that?
And you assume that someone is talking about some level of spiritual abuse within a relatively remote or safe area. It's not like someone stops you in a mall and yells, hey, Chuck, spiritual abuse has been happening to me. What are non-believers going to think? Hold it down, Larry.
Gary, you know X-name church that did me all that wrong those years ago? Yeah, let's talk about that in a very open setting. It's like, who does... What right. weird, awkward people are you around at all times that this stuff is happening?
It must happen. I guess praise God that we're not familiar with it.
Truth. Very true.
All right, number five. Stop being so bitter. He's capitalized all words except for so. People who have been hurt by a church have a right to be angry. Not only is anger an appropriate response to injustice, it's a healthy response if it's channeled the right ways. So why do Christians have such a hard time letting each other express negative emotions? Why do we always have to fish for some deeper spiritual problem like a root of bitterness? Or unforgiveness.
Yeah.
The other day I heard someone put it this way. Religion will molest you, then accuse you of being bitter about it. Do you see the double standard? When victims react to being hurt by someone in a church, we treat them as though there's something wrong with them. This is why abusers are so often exonerated. It's easier to justify letting the abuser off the hook if both parties are in the wrong. So I think there's some truth to this with, again, it's a missing a step. Churches will miss a step. Right? Something heinous happens or bad or abusive or whatever happens in a church. And like, sometimes the voices of piety come rolling out with the forgiveness step without actually having dealt with the fact that like somebody did something heinous.
Yeah.
And we should have a reaction to that. People cannot act like this to other people. People are generally hurt. People have said wrong things. They've done wrong things. They have injured another human being. That is not okay. And although there is some radical forgiveness that the Bible teaches and that Jesus demonstrates, there is an order of which we can under otherwise process things that have happened. And frankly, there are consequences for people that act foolishly. And so I think it is a potential problem just because, like, radical forgiveness does not exist anywhere else in the same way that it does in the Christian church. The call for that is not the same anywhere else. And so that being a broad possibility and something that we otherwise will work towards, I think sometimes we jump to that before actually dealing with the fact of something that has actually happened. In an attempt to do the right thing, we miss the wrong thing that has occurred and don't deal with it appropriately. I think that's something that is a potential in a church that doesn't exist in the same way everywhere else, seemingly because there just isn't that radical call to forgiveness in other places.
So a lot of the problems here are that we're just wanting to jump to everyone's healed and happy days again,
right?
Without actually going through the real process of grieving and figuring out what happened.
Yes.
And working through a very awkward and difficult situation that should not be swept under the rug and should be dealt
with. Exactly.
And at the same time, they do need to work beyond bitterness. I mean, I've had heinous things happen to me, and it's like, yeah, you are angry and you're bitter and you're hurt and you're all those things. But by golly, if I'm going to wallow in that, that's on me.
No, you know, I agree.
If I'm going to hang on to that.
I agree. I think there's a I'm not saying that's a long step. But what I'm saying is that, like, I mean, you have seen things in the church where somebody in the church has physically harmed, sexually abused, whatever, somebody else. And the victim, like, the reaction to the victim is, you just need to forgive and kind of move on from this. Ignoring the fact that, like, no, they were treated heinously. They were treated poorly. And so I think you have to deal with that without otherwise acting like something didn't happen. Because the truth is that, like, if forgiveness is you taking on basically the consequences on yourself, eating that what you were otherwise owed for reconciliation of that process, if you don't understand that correctly, then you actually have not forgiven either. And so if you don't properly forgive without otherwise properly processing what it is that has actually happened. And so I think it is a potential danger. I'm not saying that ultimately that forgiveness isn't what God is calling us to, and I'm not even calling for some sort of 6-month delay. What I'm saying is that, like, it is not we are not otherwise helping the process or helping people demonstrate complete forgiveness without actually understanding the circumstance that got them there.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You want to help them walk them through that. You can't just make a statement, stop being bitter, and walk away.
Yeah.
It's let's partner together. Let's talk about this. Pray about this. I'll be your go-to guy. Call me at 3 a.m. if you have to, if you're, you know, if you're aching and...
A lot of these actions and statements seem to operate in this vacuum of human emotion. It's like, barring the fact that you are a human being talking to another human being that has an emotion, that has felt wronged or hurt from a heinous act or from something even small, you know, if you are immediately jumping to the fact that stopping bitter, you know, nobody's perfect, all those different, these somewhat could be misplaced as defensive, but just immediately fix it guy answers without actually dealing with the human emotion that's already there, you have to unravel that before you're able to get to the deal. I equate this to I went through a class called Grief Share a couple years ago, and the concept is, yes, eventually there's a resolution to it. Eventually there's a resolution to the problem that's what's happened. But you're in this ball of emotion to begin with. You can't get to the center of the problem and fix it or accept it until you've unraveled the emotions that are there. So I think, if I remember correctly, they equate it to just a rubber band ball. And each rubber band is just a different emotion you have to deal with. And that may be over and over again the same emotion if you're unraveling it. But eventually, once you get through all of that, you can get to a resolution and to a place where it's no longer so big of an issue.
Yeah.
And I think the same is said here. This person has been wronged, and without being willing to handle the emotional stress of it and handle the emotions that are involved in being wronged, you're immediately trying to fix the situation and just cutting open the rubber band ball and taking out the resolution rather than actually detangling it and trying to figure out, okay, let's handle these one by one at a time, trying to figure that out. And once we've gotten past that and we feel comfortable with the fact that emotions did happen and they do happen, now that they've been dealt with, we can look into a resolution to move past this.
Okay. Although, the truth is, Dan's right, actually. Like, there's at some point where I would look a guy in the face and say, look, you're just holding on to bitterness.
Right, yeah.
Like, seriously, that's the truth of it. But like only if you've gone through the process of having dealt with that first, and then they actually may be holding on to bitterness. And the truth is that like you have no reason to fight that. Like, do you want to grow beyond? Do you want to move beyond this or not? Sometimes it is you. I certainly wouldn't start there.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
If you're in any form of serving Jesus in any level, you're going to get hurt at some point.
Yeah.
It just will. That's just life, because the church is imperfect.
Right.
And there's imperfect people, and they will say things that are the most unkind, rude, you know, things once in a while. I mean, it's not like your everyday experience, but it will happen.
Yeah.
Maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they just got their dog run over by a car, and they took it out on you. You don't know that part of the story, you know. And it's life, doing life in community. Sometimes it's just like a family. Sometimes you have bad days, and you're at each other, and the next day you're all lovey-dovey.
All relationships grow, I don't know, in like the soil of vulnerability, right? Yeah, like if you are not vulnerable, you cannot actually connect with someone. And to get the positive output to that, you also have to bear the risk of having been vulnerable. And some people will take advantage of that. Some people will use that gift that you've given them inappropriately. And that's just a consequence of being vulnerable. And the wrong reaction is to say, well, then I won't be vulnerable again, because like you're also missing out on the deep production of community and closeness that comes with actually doing that. Like, marriages are soaked in that. Everyday relationships are soaked in that.
Yeah,
it's just a consequence of being vulnerable, I guess.
Right. To recall something you've talked about before, Ben, if you want to live your life as the dude who lives 100 miles away from civilization in a yurt, and you can probably avoid being hurt by the church. Yeah. But obviously, you're not going to be very productive out there.
Yeah, correct. Right. You're not going to have any impact on anybody.
Exactly.
Side.
You're impacting yourself and then the bear that's by you. Like, good for you. I'm excited that eventually you'll get hurt by going crazy and thinking the flowers are yelling at you. So
now there, your vulnerability may cause you some trouble. All right, here we go. Number six. These are things what not to say to someone who has been hurt by the church. Number six, is this worth dividing the church over? This seems like an augmented version of what are non-believers going
through. Right.
How it might affect the congregation should never be the deciding factor in whether or not to expose abuse. This one especially hits home for me. When I escaped my abusive situation in Africa, my pastor wanted to sweep the whole ordeal under the rug. My silence, I was told, was for the greater good of the gospel. It wasn't a suggestion, it was an ultimatum. If I didn't keep quiet, he warned, I would bring division to the entire congregation. One of the most effective ways to silence a victim is to fill them with a false sense of guilt. The victim is led to believe that talking is only going to make things worse, and whatever happens as a result is their fault. Certainly, exposing spiritual abuse can divide a congregation, but that's not a consequence of the victim talking. It's a consequence of the abuse perpetrated in the first place. There's one thing that's even more important than knowing what not to say to someone who's been hurt by church, and that is to simply listen.
This would happen in a community of believers that does not know how to handle problems. If you develop as leadership and as the community itself, if you develop a community that is able to handle problems and realizing, you know, like we've talked about multiple times now, that the church is imperfect, that could happen. And even if you've done a good job of trying to cultivate a culture of being able to handle stress and handle problems in the church, it might happen. Would I agree with the statement that this is something you should never say to someone who's hurting? Pretty much, yeah, I would agree. I think that if someone is being abused, however we're calling that, and your statement is, well, don't say anything because you might divide the church. Yeah, that's a ridiculous statement to make to someone who's hurting. I don't understand where you're coming from if that's the statement you're going to make. You need to handle the problem. Sweeping it under the rug is, as he said or she said, I can't remember, what the pastor did. That's the complete wrong reaction.
Yeah,
That is being passive to a problem, and that is being a pansy when it comes to an issue. If you're willing to just go, oh, I don't want this to divide the church, and then be done with it, and then shush the person, you don't know how to handle things. And I'm not going to go as far as to say you should never be in leadership, but I think you definitely need to reevaluate how you handle people.
No, you should never be in leadership. Like,
fine. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. You should never be in leadership if your statement is, you know, don't let this divide the church. We're not going
to
talk about
it. Yeah, I agree. If you're trying to protect the image of the church over the integrity of the church, yes, you should never be in leadership. You are completely wrong.
Yeah, that's
fair. You're misguided and false, and yes, it's dumb. Now, I suppose if you had to have a caveat in here somewhere, it would exist in the realm of there's no reason to, like, how you go about talking about things. But it never means that you don't talk about things. Like, dealing with reality is the nature of the church. Like, we're like inviting people in to say God can handle these things. He can give you a way to process the hurts in this life and hopefully bring restoration. And if the church is saying God can't handle this, we need to hide it, then we're simply living a false narrative. And so hiding, I don't think, is the answer. You just deal with it in the right way, like taking out a banner and putting it up in the hallway so that everyone is aware of this thing that you've got an issue with. Like, that's obviously the wrong reaction. But certainly, I don't having trying to protect the integrity or the image of the body when it's the integrity of the body that's in question is foolish.
Yeah, if you show up to a church session, however you want to call that
session.
With a huge banner in your hand that says, you know, Pastor Steve wants to sweep this under the table, but I'm not going to let it happen. And then a bunch of ushers run out and then take you out of the room.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's probably not the best way to do it.
Right.
But calling for absolute silence is ridiculous.
I'm getting a whole different vibe when I start picturing someone who's very close to me, someone that I really love, like, say, my daughter or my wife, who is actually the person who, let's say, potentially they were the ones who got hurt in this situation. All of a sudden, it puts a very different spin on it as I'm evaluating these six statements. Would I say something like, no church is perfect, when my wife is coming to me and saying, hey, I was in the middle of this situation and I got hurt very badly?
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine myself ever uttering some of these words to her. But yet, you know, someone comes to me in the church and might say the exact same scenario to me, I might end up saying something like these, just because... Why?
I don't know. I think I don't feel that same way. I feel like as an example, if my wife were to come and say something like that, I think I would do what we talked about. I would we would deal with the nature of her issue first. Like, she's obviously been harmed, but if her reaction at some point is to say, "I was harmed, I'm done with churches," for perspective. This is not all the entirety of your interaction. This is not your entire, like, that's where I think that stuff lives. It's there's a very specific instance, a reason to say something like that, that has nothing to do with like actually dealing with someone's the actual thing that they're going through. It's more to kind of pull them off a tangent that otherwise doesn't deal with their issue. So, like, that would be the time I would use it. Short of that, though, yes, I agree that it doesn't apply, but I think there are instances in which it does, whereas if your reaction, the thing that has been done to you is unhealthy, but if your reaction is equally unhealthy, I think there are some off-the-ledge things that you say to someone that says, you know, like, I'm asking you to process within the right context, within the right perspective.
I think that, we're not called to be completely void of human emotion. We can handle that. But I agree, Ben. I think that there's a point that, as someone who has been wronged or has been hurt, we do have a responsibility and a calling to make sure that we are not dwelling upon it from the perspective of never allowing resolution and never allowing forgiveness to happen.
Well,
even if we've been hurt, we are called to forgive, and that needs to happen. And you can't operate well in some place where you think that I've been hurt, but I'm not willing to be moving past it. I'm never willing to let this go. Not even just from a non-Christian standpoint, not even just a Christ follower's perspective, any human being that refuses to move past a wrongdoing and refuses to move past that in life is wrong. They need to move past that. It's unhealthy from a human perspective.
Right, and I think that's the point. And actually, going back to what Dave said, though, I think that is the right perspective. Is like, how would you react to these things if it was someone that was... you loved, because that should be how you're dealing with people, right? Now, right. I would, to move it to what you're saying, is I would look my daughter in the eye as we're processing this and say, baby, it is for your good. It's for your long-term health of your relationships and your life that we need to look at what forgiveness looks like in this situation, because it is healthy for them to do so.
Right.
And so, like, it would be healthy at some point for me to say, look, you can't let this bitter thing take over your life. It is defining you. So,
yes.
Like, all those things sitting in the right context and in the right position, I think can be helpful things and things I would say to someone I very dearly love. But how you're saying it, when you're saying it, and the process of which they're kind of going through that valley of dealing with whatever it is that's happened to them, if you're handling it the way you would of someone that you dearly love, then those things will come out not feeling the way that he's describing them. But the way he's describing them is coming out of the mouth of someone that says, I don't really care about you. I care about resolving the situation. And that's the grand falsehood of dealing with this thing that he's talking about,
right.
is that you're dealing with a circumstance and not an individual sitting in front of you. And then any of these things will return void because they're not rooted in love. They're rooted in some sort of weird cover-up that the church is trying to propagate.
Yeah, empathize with the human emotion that's happening, but at the same point in time, don't find yourself enabling them to stay in a self-deprecating rut. They need to get out of that at some point in time. Now, there's not a specific timeline to put on that. It may take a day. It may take a couple weeks. It may take a year. Whatever it may be, don't empathize, but don't enable.
Yeah, I think Dave's nailed it, though. Like, just whatever it is that people are coming up to you, and frankly, throw out that it's a spiritual abuse problem. Take it anything. Handle it the way you would, as if you're your mother or your daughter or brother or whoever, someone close to you, they came to you with the same thing. What would your reaction be? And that's, you've probably got the right tenor on how you should be dealing with people.
Yeah.
All right. That was the six. What not to say to someone who's been hurt by church.
I've done a few.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I've, I don't know, I just really haven't encountered this, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm more likely to encounter the person who is upset at the church in general for things that otherwise everyone would agree on. I don't like your standing on the social issue. B, it's full of people that are sinning like me, and I say, yes, sir, there's room for you.
Welcome to the flock.
And so, you know, things that I don't think are actually all that debatable. we just agree on whether you'll stand with the group of people over here or whether you want to be angry with the group of people over here. All right. Anyway, that's Relevant Magazine, what not to say to someone who's been hurt by church. If maybe we got this thing wrong, guys. Hey, if you're listening to it and you're like, you've been in that situation or you had a circumstance that we're not contemplating well, I'd like to learn and grow through that. So if we're striking the wrong mark here and your experience would show otherwise, shoot us an email. Do it anonymously if you need to. Twitter, Facebook, send us mail. I don't care. But like, we're always looking to grow through that kind of stuff. So I don't have personal experience with this. So I'm willing for other things to teach me differently. My rational mind doesn't always contemplate well what actual circumstances do to people. So help me grow on that. If you got a story that would help us out, let me know and send it to us so that we can kind of learn and digest. And it doesn't have, we won't do it on the air. If it's something where you don't want it read or anything, it's just for us. Totally cool. We'd like to hear about it, but don't gossip, for heaven's sake.
I was going to say, or they could just call a friend.
For heaven's sakes.
Never mind.
And then the friend can call a friend.
All right. Very good. What else did I say we're going to get to today? Modesty. Hold on. Holy cats. Look, the day's getting away.
I was going to say, no, we spent a long time on that one.
Oh, man. All right, here we go. Let's see if we can hit modesty. While popular culture tends to disempower women by telling them they must dress to get men to look at them, the modesty culture tends to disempower women by telling them they must dress to keep men from looking at them. What I've only just begun to realize is that these two extremes represent different sides of the same coin. In both cases, the impetus is placed on the woman to accommodate her clothing, her body, to the varied and culturally relative expectations of men. In both cases, it becomes a woman's job to manage the sexual desires of men, and thus it is seen as her fault if a man ignores her on the one hand or objectifies her on the other. Often these two cultures combine to send out a pulse of confusing messages. Look cute, but not too cute. Be modest, but not frumpy. Make yourself attractive, but not too attractive. Women are left feeling ashamed of their bodies. They try desperately to contort around a bunch of vague, ever-changing ideals. It's exhausting, really, dressing for other people. You agree with that? We sending out mixed signals to the ladies. They don't know what to do with themselves.
Between everyone, yes. Like the whole of society of the church or whatever you want to call it. Yes, we do send out a lot of mixed signals when it comes to this. You've got people that feel that showing any amount of beauty is a problem, and you know, wearing anything but pretty much a sweater a hoodie and sweatpants at all times is a problem. I've seen that happen. I've heard that from people.
Yeah.
Where you can't show anything or you're going to cause your brothers to sin. I've also seen the perspective of you shouldn't care about what you're wearing. It's not your problem to cover yourself up. You dress how you should feel beautiful and then leave the fellas to themselves. They need to take care of themselves. I've heard both of those in person. I've heard both of those. And that's confusing even for me as a dude, and I don't have to tailor to it. I don't really get told on how tight my pants should be. I think that I myself find identity kind of I, for lack of a better term, in the middle. Just because, yes, I think that there is a level of modesty that we should expect from Christ-following women to make sure that they're not, I mean, completely hanging out of all their clothes and dressing awful. And I think that that's a subjective comment, but we can all kind of agree that what that may mean. You know, we don't have to go into specifically like how much cleavage you show, whatever, all the different stuff. I'm not really worried about that. It's more of a hard issue than it is actually what your waistline is. But I think that from what I've seen, and I've actually talked to people about this, and people have asked me, I think that if you are calling into question yourself in regards to what you're wearing, and could this be something that I'm actually going to cause someone to fail because, you know, I'm showing too much off right now, maybe take a look at what you're doing. And if that's something that you're realizing from yourself, talk to another woman about it. Talk to another woman of faith about that. That's your guide. Don't come to me about it because I'm not going to be the right person to talk about it. But find a woman of faith in your church or in your community to talk to about that. You know, convene in regards to that. Is this okay? Is this a problem? And then find yourself on the right side of that. I don't think that there's an easy way to talk about an industry standard, though, when it comes to this is what you should wear, this is what you shouldn't wear. However, I do think that you should be modest to the perspective of take care of yourself. Don't show too much off because you're a beautiful person, and that's not for everyone. But at the same point in time, if you feel like you have to dress to the point where you can never feel beautiful, that's not what God intended.
So what's the right measure here then? How do we is that the article of describing modesty correctly? What's the right way to understand that concept?
I'd say it's describing the conversation correctly. I mean, all those conversations are definitely going on. A woman just has to be aware, rather than, you know, pouting about, oh, they're telling me how to dress, you just need to be aware that how you dress will determine how men will look at you. Just know that. You just need to know that. I mean, it's just what it is. You can say men are a bunch of pigs. Yes, we are. I'm a pig. What can I say? And some people have no, some men have no boundaries, and they will go further than other men. You just need to know that some men are going to undress you, even if you're wearing a hoodie and sweatpants. You know, so that's just what it is. Mentally undress you, excuse me.
Right, that's a much different circumstance you're talking about. Clarify. There, Dan.
Wow, Dan lives in a weird world.
No, that's actually, I think Dan actually brings up something that is often missed in this particular conversation, is that it's relative, the amount that a man, yeah, like the culture of piggish men,
yeah,
you could be wearing a blanket, I mean, exactly, like 10 blankets.
Yeah.
And like a dude is going to find a way to see a hump that is just slightly bigger than something else that's going on and be like, ooh, ooh, a blanket hump.
I know what that might be.
A blanket.
I mean, so that's the truth, is like sometimes where I think this goes askew is the conversation about modesty starts to talk about buckles and strap lengths and widths of things.
Yeah, and you can't,
like,
control
it.
Don't care.
You're dealing with yeah. I'm not absolving men of the responsibility to not be that.
Right.
But the truth is that, like, there's some ladies who can walk around bare-chested all the time in some cultures, and you don't have the same problem as showing an ankle somewhere else. And yeah, so, like, men are capable of adapting to their circumstances of piggishness. So I think the distinctives within this conversation, I think, blind the otherwise root to the conversation, which is, I mean, what is this all about? What is this all for? What are we dressing for? I mean, a lot of times it's just a measure of, I'm trying to keep cooler in the middle of the summer and not, right, wear a sweater. Yeah, dig it. It's not about trying to attract a guy.
So I think the Christ-following woman needs to focus on their relationship with Jesus and just keep in mind the male mind at the same time, the balance there. You know, if she spends all of her time worried about, oh no, is this showing or that showing, that, you know, have I got 6 inches here or, you know, too much ankle, you know, it'll drive you crazy. So you just focus on Jesus and, but see, I'm putting that through my own filter of modesty. What attracted me to my wife was her modesty,
right?
You know, it just attracted me to her because that was not where her sense of beauty came from. Her beauty was in Jesus and how he has transformed and changed her life. And those are the things that attract me. She was also a very beautiful woman. Yeah, see, I'm contradictory in even my own self, because I did notice, you know?
Yeah. I don't think that's the problem. I don't think the problem is noticing that it's there. Like, I don't think that's the issue. I think the fact of the matter is where guys' minds go after that.
Yeah, yeah.
Ultimately, we're...
And some things are harder to stop your mind.
Right.
Some article of clothing that women will wear than
yes.
others.
And so I think that I would agree with your premise from the woman's perspective. I think that you should always seek, you know, what you feel Jesus wants from you. And I think that the relationship that you have with him is going to help dictate what that means to you. And I don't think you should waste a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, what exactly, like, length of pants should I be wearing, or how high should my shirt be, whatever like that. If you want to spend your time doing that, I just don't think it's going to be very productive. Because you're right, it is very subjective. I could think something is lacking modesty where you think that's perfectly modest. I agree with that. From dudes, I think that we're called, and we fail on this a lot, realize that no matter what you see, you're probably going to be able to derive some form of sexual immorality from looking at a gal, just because that's how your brain works, you creep. But... we need to make sure that we're not pinning all of the responsibility on women.
Well, it's not their responsibility at all. I mean, to the extent that they're not responsible for, and this is one thing the article, are these your notes or these article stuff here?
I quoted directly from the article, okay. But these are the highlights of
okay,
it.
Okay, so there were three warnings that came from the article, and the first one was, we turn modesty into objectification when we hold women responsible for the thoughts and actions of men. I would agree that it is not a woman's responsibility. My thoughts and actions are my own responsibility.
Right.
Truth be told, a lady should be able to walk around like drop dead foolishly dressed, and I should be able to handle my own thoughts and actions.
Yeah.
But I was thinking in the context of what would I tell my daughter. She is not responsible for the thoughts and actions of men, but the truth is that she lives in a world full of men. And regardless of whether I optimistically said half were willing Christ followers who had this under control, that still puts the odds in poor favor of luring in a pig-headed man looking in her direction.
And men are visually stimulated.
Women are too. I think that they oversold that. But yeah, definitely. I agreed. Men are visually stimulated. And so the odds are for my daughter's protection, and frankly for the type of attention that she wants, like, I agree with Dan, like, you need to keep in mind that if you're dressing for a certain way because you want a guy to look at you, you can't be surprised that he does, and just recognize one out of 10,000 is going to have the right mindset in doing it. And so It is sometimes we get this hyper feminist argument that says ladies should do whatever they want, and I'm like, I'm not necessarily arguing against that, but just to understand that there are consequences to that in a
right.
fallen world, of which there are men that will look at you in a way that you want to try to avoid that as much as possible. And there is reality, whether you like this for your personal ladies freedom or not, there is a reality in there are ways that you can dress that keeps certain things from happening. It doesn't eliminate all things from happening, but let's at least be honest with our conversation that there is some reality to that. And I would say that to my daughter, not because she's not, I don't want her to be beautiful or to find a man that finds her physically appealing. It's just there is a reality of a fallen world, and to the extent that you can hedge against that, I think it's best that you do.
I think that to tackle, and I agree with everything you just said, I think that we need to make sure that we're not putting the responsibility on women for men's actions, and I actually like what you said in regards to understanding the consequences of living in a fallen world. I'd never heard it put like that, so I agree with that. But to speak to dudes, I think if you're spending more of your time trying to figure out what modesty should mean in a woman's heart rather than what purity should mean in yours, you're at fault. You need to spend more time focusing on what purity means for you than what modesty means for them.
Okay, agreed. There were two more, and then if we have additional thoughts, we'll probably have to get them after the break. Number two was, we turn modesty into objectification when we assume there are single standards that apply to all people in all cultures. That's what we talk, bare-chested lady versus ankle. I think that's accurate. Mm-hmm. And number three, finally, we turn modesty into objectification when we make women ashamed of their bodies. God made it. So I would agree with that, too. All right. If you got other things you want to ponder about, let's hit them up after the break. Hey, you've been listening to Live from the Path. Thanks for hanging out with us on 99.3 The Truth Network. And here's the deal. If you want to hook up with the show, maybe you like to, you can't be tied down to the radio. I dig on that. Hook up with our podcast. Go to livefromthepath.org. Also, big thanks to our sponsors, Bob Eisenhower with the Eisenhower Team. Go to eisenhowerteam.com for all your home buying and selling needs. Bob is your man. Also, Westfield Veterinary Hospital, westfieldvethospital.com. You can set up your appointment online for all your pet care needs. They do dogs, cats, rabbits, the occasional horse. I, you know, whatever. They got the thing down. It's where I take my pets because they do an awesome job, and we're very proud to have them as a sponsor. If you're listening to the podcast, we'll be right back with you. If not, we got to let you go. Thank you for listening to Live from the Path. What were we? What was the last time? Modest is hottest. Was that the last time we were talking about that movie?
Yeah, Modest is hottest. Oh man, yeah, that was years ago. I haven't heard Modest is hottest in years.
This is one of those conversations where, and I mean, there's probably a good trunk of 50 of them, and this is one of them of which you rarely ever see people actually talk about what's in question. They are constantly talking past each other.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
like they're fighting for extremes on things that no one is actually saying. And it is rarely a productive discussion, because they've just decided that what they think either the personal integrity of ladies or the personal freedom of ladies is under attack, and no one really is willing to cede ground that they're, I'm not even saying it has to be a middle ground because that's probably the wrong proposition, but that, nobody on either side is actually all that angry about it. They've got something that they care about and they're wanting to make sure they're heard about it. And so, some of these shows, our show is a little bit different where, like, some people spend their time talking about the 50 things in the bucket. And, like, there's a lot of things, we just don't talk about because they're not productive discussions. Most of the guys in the room already agree on it, for one. And two, I don't think us are clearly articulating our point. They're smarter guys. There's more theologically weighted fellas that can make better arguments for certain things than we can. And I just... they're not moving the needle. I'm not sure that we're going to either. And so there's certain things like that. This one is almost like that for me, but I think it was worth the discussion to at least, I don't know, admit that there's not necessarily, that there is a middle in there somewhere, that we're not fighting for either the ultra conservative or the ultra liberalistic view. People I think are just wanting to be heard that says, I don't want you to make me feel like I have to be ashamed of what God has given me. And second of all, we don't want you to do, it is a false narrative to say that is completely disassociated from the actions of men in a fallen world. So, all right. Do you have any other parting thoughts on that?
Well, I was just going to say at some point in there that, you know, in a culture where women wear burkas, they're still abused.
Yeah.
You know, it's just what it is, you know, by that small segment of guys who have no boundaries and they know what's down there, so they'll find it. They'll go after it.
Yep. All right. Anyway, that's what we got going on. I can't remember. Did you have something? Did you have something going on?
I can if you would like me to, but I thought we had a third article.
Oh, yeah, we were called to make disciples, not converts. All right, here we go. Let's hit this one. This is also, we're topping out the Relevant Magazine's Keeping Us in Business this week. These guys aren't necessarily, well, no, there's a forlorn guy. The other guy is talking to the forlorn guy. Trying to straighten things out. There's your standard guy's got a stocking hat on in the middle of summer. Anyway.
You know those pictures are entirely arbitrary, right?
Yeah, but someone still has to go, yeah, put that on the article.
Okay.
Like there's some brooding person who does the article picture work for Relevant Magazine. It doesn't make me feel relevant to me because my life is not filled with brooding fellas.
That's kind of ironic coming from a place called Relevant.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. Okay. Tricky. Actually, think about who you're drawing in. This is relevant to whom? Another brooding man. Okay. Anyway, has a culture of convenience and consumerism changed the way we preach the gospel? What if I told you that Jesus didn't want us to win converts? This guy, sorry, I'm getting distracted by stuff. What if I said that in all of Scripture, that guy looks like the vampire man from...
he's still looking at the picture, Ben.
No, Twilight. Not this. No, this is the guy that actually wrote the article. He's got like a black background and a black shirt, and he's a pale guy, and he's just kind of up into the thing.
A vampirical picture.
Hold on. I feel like you're describing me right about now.
Okay, hold on.
No, you look like the Bohemian Rhapsody video.
Can you see him?
All right. Yeah.
Hold on. Let me get
you. Oh, man, that's creepy. That's like...
Look at him. There he is.
He's angry.
That is the most emo picture I've ever
seen. Someone converted him.
Doesn't he look a little vampirish?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. There's the forlorn guy.
That is the most hipster picture I've seen this week.
Okay, sorry. I can't. This thing's going to distract me. I can't have reasonable conversations.
That's beautiful.
All right. So what if I told you that Jesus didn't want us to win converts? What if I said that in all of Scripture we are never told to convert anyone? What if I proposed that people accepting Jesus into their life does not fulfill our mission? We may share the gospel, but it's not always the same gospel Jesus shared. Our version can be a little softer. It can be easier. The message too often has been watered down. Many of us don't want to be called radicals. Many of us take the message of Jesus and we omit some of the more intense parts because they might scare people away. I don't know a part of Jesus' thing that isn't really intense.
Right.
Here we go. Inconvenient truth. Out of our desire to win converts, we've often tried to make Jesus more convenient. That's what our culture is all about. So watering down the gospel to reflect the culture can be an easy trap to fall into. We often make following Jesus comfortable and easy, reducing the expectations, You don't have to do anything different. Just believe. Carrying our cross has been reduced from a radical relationship of self-sacrificing love and humility to cheap advertisements with bracelets, jewelry, and bumper stickers. We turned following Jesus into little more than internal fire insurance. In doing so, we made him something he is not, safe. What happened to Dietrich Bonhoeffer's idea of when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die? I don't know. Stop point. So far?
Right on.
I'm with him.
Yeah. I think he's nailed it so far.
Yeah.
I think that's been the downfall of the American church.
Yep. Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
When I say downfall, I mean the wimpization.
Why does the American church rail against so many other things?
I'm sorry, what?
Why does the American church rail against so many other things then?
Oh, that are not disciple issued?
Yeah.
Not really Jesus centered. The social issues and the,
Because we're hard headed Americans.
We've got to fight something. Someone has to be the enemy. And if it's not,
if it's not us, like if you're not spending any time looking at yourself, that means you have nothing else to do but look at other people. And so the conversation then turns outward.
Well, it's kind of our nature,
I guess. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Agreed.
We need an enemy.
Oh. All right.
Let's see. Here we go. Out of our desire to win converts, we've often tried to make Jesus more convenient. Oh, yeah. Okay. We got to that part. When we sell people on a Jesus who is easy to follow, can we really blame them for bailing out or drifting off when things don't go smoothly? It shouldn't be surprising living in consumer-based culture that many times people bring the same attitudes into church. It's my way, my preferences, my desires are important. If I don't get my way, I'll take my business elsewhere. In watering down the gospel, we have taken what is all about Jesus and made it all about us. Jesus is part of our lives when he should be our life. He is life. Following him requires all our life. The disciples ate, drank, sweat, and slept ministry from when Jesus called them to the day they died. Jesus wasn't part of their lives. He was their life. That might be an overly optimistic view of the disciples' reaction. Their presence, I'm not sure, necessarily describes their understanding and commitment.
Is this in the same magazine of the same where the article was, "The guys hurt my feelings. Don't say mean things to me."
All right, Dan, that was about a potentially accurate spiritual abuse, but yes.
Well, what did Jesus say? Take up your cross, dude. Quit being bitter. Come on, let's go. So the Pharisees are rough on you.
Come on, let's go, he says.
Pharisees are rough. That's what they are. Follow me.
Dan finds some troubles with the types of articles relevant magazines.
No, I just think they're a little contradictory.
Actually, you know what's funny? It's funny you brought that up, though, because their lead article for this month in the magazine is the top Christian bumper stickers ranked.
Oh my God.
That's like going to Exponential where they mock the attraction style of church, and the whole conference is attraction.
Oh, yeah, it's big signs, awesome band, good music.
Like, I don't know what you're trying to do here.
Yeah.
Don't talk about the show, but put on a good show.
Anyway, sorry. That was just an observation completely irrelevant of the article.
We're all guilty of putting things above Jesus, whether it's health, wealth, comfort, causes, dreams, hobbies, or interests. We all come to Jesus with expectations of what he will do for us. We all have our passions and causes, but Jesus didn't come to take sides. Jesus came to take over. Oh, man. He should have said Jesus came to take names. That would have been powerful. All right.
You and
send him some feedback. I'm sure there's a way to.
Dear sir, I found a culturally relevant way for you to change the sentence.
Use my picture.
Hey, man, you can make Jesus more flashy. Here's how.
There's a bra advertisement right next to this. This site
is relevant.
You need to get off modest. Of relevant.com because apparently you can't read through an article.
What is the necessity of this right here? Anyway, coming back to what I was doing.
It's going to take us an hour.
Many people come to Jesus thinking he's enough to believe, to stand on the sidelines and root for him. Jesus isn't looking for cheerleaders. He is seeking men and women who will follow him whatever the cost. He's looking for radical devotion, unreasonable commitment, and undivided dedication. Jesus isn't looking for converts. He's looking for disciples. Converts are new believers. We all start as converts. Too often we stop there. We make Christianity all about what we believe. Converts aren't bad or wrong. They're like babies. There's nothing wrong with being a baby. The problem comes when that doesn't change. When a baby acts like a baby, it's cute. When a 35-year-old does, it's sad. As Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13:11, "When I was a child, I talked like a child, thought like a child, reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me." For years, churches have worked to get people to make a decision to accept Christ, which is a great thing. It's important. But what happens next? Where's the follow-up? How do we train up new Christians? Our mission isn't to win converts, it's to make disciples. So what is the difference? Here we go. Converts are believers who live like the world. Disciples are believers who live like Jesus. Converts are focused on their values, interests, worries, fears, priorities, and lifestyles. Disciples are focused on Jesus. Converts go to church. Disciples are the church. Converts are involved in the mission of Jesus. Disciples are committed to it. Converts cheer from the sidelines. Disciples are in the game. Converts hear the word of God. Disciples live it. Converts follow the rules. Disciples follow Jesus. Converts are all about believing. Disciples are all about being. Converts are comfortable. Disciples make sacrifices. Converts talk. Disciples make more disciples. A disciple is someone who wholeheartedly follows the life and example of Jesus, who makes his mission, his values their values, and his heart their heart. A disciple is someone who desperately seeks to be like Jesus. A disciple is someone so committed to the cause of Christ that they would follow him through the gates of hell and back. A disciple is someone who finds their entire identity, purpose, and meaning in Jesus. Jesus is the center of their lives. They are all in, fully committed. Not only is a disciple willing to die for Jesus, but they are dedicated to living every day of their life for him. Jesus doesn't call us to be converts or to win converts. Jesus calls us to make disciples. Jesus offers us grace and love without condition, but not without expectation. When we try to water down the message by saying things like, you don't have to give up sin, you don't have to change, you don't have to be transformed, you don't have to die to yourself, you just need to believe. In doing this, not only are we depriving people of truth, we are denying them access to a real transforming relationship with the Almighty God. Christianity isn't just a system of belief. It isn't a lifestyle. It's a life transformed by Jesus. Jesus doesn't call everyone to leave everything every day. He calls us to be willing to give up everything at any point. His call for each of us is different. He has uniquely gifted every person to carry out a unique and valuable function in his kingdom. While what we are called to may be unique, the call is an extreme standard. Jesus must be greater than everything else. I don't find anything to argue with in that.
No, I think it's solid.
Yeah, I think he's got that nailed. Well, here's
a thought I've had the last few days. I've really been thinking a lot about, well, the last couple of years, but, well, the last 30 years. Okay.
Is it relevant?
It's relevant. It's relevant, okay.
About vampires?
I'm thinking pendulum swings, right?
Yeah.
The pendulum for a few decades was convert, 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 and everything the article just said. The pendulum has swung, is in the process still of swinging toward discipleship, and that's a good thing. I think that's a positive thing. But if we're not careful, it's going to swing so far that we're going to almost disqualify people who are really genuinely in early stage of discipleship. And I don't know what I'm trying to say. Okay, I'm trying to word this to what I'm really thinking. Okay, we've overcomplicated it. There are systems and books and classes, and there's all these things because we're trying to make disciples, which is the good thing. But we can overcomplicate it so much, like with the conversation you and I have had, Ben.
So much emphasis on obedience that we forget about grace?
No, not even saying that. I'm just saying, like, we're so caught up on the system. Like I've had multiple conversations with all of you guys saying, okay, we're not making disciples. I think, well, what makes me say that? Well, we're not making it well enough. We could do it more efficiently, right? You know, it's like, well, we really need to ramp up our disciple making. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, what does Jesus say in Matthew 28? It's pretty simple. The Great Commission, the imperative is to make disciples. That's our command. And there are the three participles, the going, as you go, the baptizing, and the teaching. The big thing is the teaching. That's usually what we're focused on, because the baptism, you know, happens as a one-time event. The going is as you go. It's the bringing more in. What is that? The teaching them all things, to obey all things, right? That's like the rest of your life. You know, it's not like, oh, I've gone through this 6-week class, so now I've been discipled, or a year, or 6 year, or 12 year. You know, when do we decide? What do you mean we're not discipling? Every study that happens, every conversation that happens, is part of the discipleship process. Now, I think where we have failed is we haven't been as intentional of saying, what's your next step? You know, wherever you are, whatever you're taking, whether you're in the discipleship thing that we're doing, whether you're in a Sunday school class, adult Sunday school class, whether you're in a small group that's meeting, talking about whatever, that's all discipleship. But we need to maybe tighten up the intentionality of saying that we're really moving forward, not just talking Bible, we're moving forward to be followers of Jesus. You know what? You hear what I'm saying?
Well,
Am I bouncing around too much in my own head?
No. I think I understand and otherwise would agree with the distinction that you're making. I think everything you're talking about is a right opportunity for discipleship. A disciple is a it's revealed, right? So, but it does convert to action. I actually think that the article has made some of the right distinctions.
Yeah.
Where we're saying converts are, like it's a difference between what you otherwise think versus what you otherwise do, right? And so I think we've misplaced some of the words of disciple to act like if a disciple isn't otherwise living things out, then that's not a follower.
Right.
And so, everything you're talking about is an opportunity for those things that are happening. But like, if it isn't producing an otherwise a work that follows or actions that follow, then I would say then, although it is an opportunity for discipleship, it's not happening. Discipleship is not happening. And the question is like, if our imperative to make disciples is to create discipleship opportunities, or is there something else besides that that otherwise says, is our only job to create opportunity, or is there a larger thing that you're committed to that has to say something has to happen within that opportunity to make sure disciples are actually being made?
Yeah. And that's the job of the leadership within each of those opportunities. You know, whether it's a small group leader, a Sunday school teacher, a discipleship leader in a discipleship group is we're helping people move forward. And sometimes maybe that's the point we forgot. We're like the teacher shows up and they just teach us a lesson and figure, well, it's up to you to do something rather than following up saying, hey, what are we doing with this? Or the small group leader having the conversations beyond going through those questions they went through or the conversation they had at small group, having the personal conversations. How can I help you grow spiritually? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure this out. I hate to pigeonhole. How do we decide, well, now we're making disciples? Well, now we aren't. And I have been guilty of saying, well, I've never been discipled. Well, obviously I have. I've gotten to this point. You know, I don't know what system, I don't know. I guess I'm talking out of confusion more. Asking more questions than answering. You know what I'm saying? I don't know that we have the answer. I don't know that we can say, well, now we're making disciples when there we weren't, or I don't know. Help!
Dave? Set us straight on this one.
Are you teaching people to obey Jesus?
Yeah, at every avenue, everything we do.
That's making disciples.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're making disciples. Can we be more efficient? Yes. Can we be more intentional? Absolutely. Can we ramp things up? Oh, yeah. But we've never not made disciples. Even in, you know, we're going back to where I grew up, and I say, well, I've never been discipled. Well, yeah, I have. I've been in classrooms. I've talked to preachers. I've talked to leaders. I've talked to people. A lot of that goes to the learner's responsibility to care, to want to learn. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what we have not done a very good job of getting the initial follower to say, no, really, follow. You got to follow. You know, to get beyond the I said the little prayer, I rose my hand, whatever it was, the conversion, mm-hmm. and say, that's step one. The rest of your life is a growth process. You're not done. You're just started. Maybe that's where we've gone slightly soft. I'm just asking questions. I don't know. That's what's been swirling around my little head as I'm trying to figure this out. Because, you know, especially from the conversation Ben and you and I had recently.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how do we know when we've started? How do we know when we haven't done it? Well, of course we're doing it. I've said we haven't, but yeah, I mean, we're doing what Jesus said as we're going and we're teaching to obey all things. Are we overcomplicating it?
Well, so I'm maybe that's the question, though, is that like If you're teaching to obey all things, like I don't know, is our scope wrong, right? Have we gotten satisfied with too small of a scope?
Yeah. And well, you gotta take the 101 class first. You know.
Well, so like what? If our I mean, you could sit there and you could be, if the scope of your discussion is always John 3:16 in every baptism package you could find. Like
yeah.
Like you may have been telling people to be faithful in some things,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So, but if your scope is limited, you know, like there has to be something where, like, the Bible seems to be pretty clear about fruit being produced, right? Like,
that's Jesus gives the scope, though. He says, "As you go," I mean, that's the beginning part of
teaching all things.
Is that conditional while you're going? So,
yeah,
you know, if you encounter a baptistry, you talk about a baptism. If you're at a Quickie Mart, you talk about being at a Quickie Mart and obeying Jesus there. I mean, it's living life together. Wherever you happen to be, that's what you talk about. And that's kind of what Jesus did, too, is wherever he was, he would just grab things from the environment and say, hey, look at this. I'm the rock that, you know, this is going to be built on.
Well, I think that's what I'm getting at. I was scoping in a slightly different way, though, is that, like, if our scope is limited to when I run into you on Sunday about the prescribed thing that we are going to talk about, right, that's not disciple making.
Right. No.
That will not produce disciples, right? So, like, if you are, if even, and I think.
Well, it is a piece of it.
Well, but like.
You're talking about like kind of a Bible lesson.
Let me ask you. No. If that is the only thing that happened.
Well, then you're falling short. Yeah.
Right, so, and that's what I'm getting at is that, like, I think that's where our scope has fallen. Like where your scope is not right, because we've been able to kind of package of what it looks like to make disciples in programs, in things of which something is to happen.
We've made it professional.
Yeah, correct. Correct.
The preacher should. I should call the preacher because my friend has a question. Rather than I'm at the Quickie Mart. And I have an
I'll
answer.
Take care of it.
It's just not integrated, and it's not life integrated. It's just event integrated. Here's the point in time and the circumstance and the place of which we make disciples, and here's the things we talk about to get there.
Yeah.
And like that is the false narrative.
If that's the case, then that's the only time in which they're obedient to Christ is when they're in that building and in that classroom.
So when we look and we say, you know, if you're trying to gauge and say, are we making disciples? I mean, I suppose you could say there will be some output for the limited opportunities that you've otherwise set up to make disciples. But like to the extent that people that you as an individual or as a community do not have that integrated into your life, of which it is happening at all circumstances outside of those pre-programmed events and in the general relationships that you're in, like, yes, you will look out and I think you will see that the fruit of that will be you're simply not making very many disciples.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like our cafe downstairs should be a disciple making machine. Where people are having conversations and helping each other along in the faith, rather than just talk. I mean, they can talk about whatever's on the sports page too. That's why we have a newspaper there. But that should be a place where a lot of just disciple making is happening, as we're talking, like we're talking right now around the table. We're just having a conversation and kind of like, well, where are we going with this? What does this look like? And why can't they have? Man, things are struggling at work. Well, what do you think of this?
So I think that's the deal though. Is that like it is more of an expansion of scope that says wherever we've narrowed the place in which we feel like the times and events of which disciples are made, you're going to see poor fruit out of minimal circumstances and corporate events. But that's the discipleship that is helping. People know how to do that.
People are afraid they have to make the conversion. Going back to this article, because that's why they won't say anything. Well, I've got to have the outline and have all the answers. We need a baptism. It's like, no, just have a conversation.
But I think that gets to what I was going to say though is that people don't know what to do. That's where I think some of the conversations we've had about discipleship, where you say I haven't been discipled, there is a block that says I don't even know what that looks like. If you haven't seen it demonstrated or lived close to or by with friends or community or family that have lived like that, sometimes it's very difficult to look out and say I don't even know what this is. And so I think that's why it doesn't happen a lot with people, and so like our scope stays small, and then we end up not making either very many or disciples at all, because it's not a fully integrated life.
It's like saying I was never parented. Well, yes, I was. I don't remember going to when the class when Dad sat me down and said, "Now, son, this is how you act." It just happened. I just lived in a family that became probably more like my dad than I would like to admit.
Yeah.
That's it. Just it's a natural, organic. It just happens. It happens. But we have to be some intentional with it.
I think it doesn't happen though. Like I think otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation. I think you do run into where things are event oriented, and it doesn't just naturally happen. Somehow it became unnatural. It became to the point where like this feels like it is things are supposed to happen in this realm, and then they don't naturally outflow into your life.
Because people have lost the permission to be engaged in the commission, the conversation. They want the professionals to come in.
Yeah.
The way that I've been explained in regards to what the difference between going from dealing with converts to dealing with disciples, and the way that I've explained it is from the food perspective, the spiritual food. You've got people that are being fed, and you've got that we'll call that our baseline of being a convert. The person is being fed. The next progression, and even if you think about it from a child's perspective, is they start to feed themselves. And I think the same could be said for a convert to a disciple. The convert may not really know how to feed themselves. They may not know where to get the food and things like that. And it's our job to show them that and show them what that means. And then they start to feed themselves. But it's not from the perspective of then that's it. Then that's done. The person doesn't just start feeding themselves and go, okay, great. Now I know how to feed myself. The eventual portion next would be, are you feeding others? and teaching others to feed themselves. And then going forward, are those people teaching others to feed themselves? And are those people going forward to teach others to feed themselves? You've got this cycle of people going from not being able to feed themselves to learning how to actually live out that life and being a disciple, and then going out and going and teaching others to do the same thing. And that's where you've got this self-fulfilling cycle of making disciples to make more disciples, and then it goes out and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And from what I've seen and from what I've read in Jesus's stories and his parables and things like that, that's what it looks like to me, is someone is going from just being fed to feeding themselves to finally going forth and teaching others to feed themselves. And it's this, I'm going to receive learning, I'm going to go and seek learning, and then I'm going to teach.
And it's continually,
Continually happens. It's not just a one-time process and then, oh, now I'm a disciple.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not this badge that you earn and then you're done. It's
what's the chasm here?
Okay, all right. Yeah. Being a disciple is following Jesus and teaching others to follow Jesus. And then the question is, are they then also perpetuating this? Is it going on from there or not? If they are, then you're apparently adequately teaching them how to follow Jesus. And if not, what's missing? Why?
And that's Dan's question. What's the chasm?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What is it?
Why are people not?
I mean, let's just even just look at our particular church. That's kind of been part of our conversation. Is how do we get this machine rolling? It's got to be beyond, hey, a different class or a different thing or a system. It's an organic thing that should just be naturally happening. It's just what happens with believers.
I think it's expectations that need to be set. If we've set the expectation that here's another avenue for you to learn. You know, here's another class that we're offering for you to learn.
But we had those from day one.
Right. I'm saying that's probably not the answer.
Uh-huh.
Is to come up with another avenue for them to learn. If people don't want to be that, they're never going to be. If people don't want to start reciprocating being a follower of Jesus and being a disciple, it's not going to happen. And I don't think getting people on board with, there's more for what I need to be doing. If we can't get them on board with that, a fancy new class isn't going to help.
Yeah.
We have to get people to the point where they understand that where they're at right now, whether that be just understand or coming to church and showing up on Sundays and saying, I'm good. If that's where they're at, that's the problem. If they stay there, that's an issue. If all they get is, I receive this deal and all the church is something that I plug into, I get out of, and then I walk out. That's a problem. If we can't hook them in on continuing that and trying to actually push for a relationship with Jesus, not just the show up and deal with it thing. And
I mean, we just spent, 28 weeks on the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know how much more can you hear about following Jesus.
I think the missing element is Jesus. We lift him up. We show how awesome he is. People are going to want to follow him and pass that on. And if we don't, if we downplay Jesus and treat him like he's common, then why would anyone want to do that?
But that's what I'm saying. We're not. Like, we just spent 28 weeks, whatever, on the Sermon on the Mount, and there's still people like, well, yeah, but I got a softball game, so I guess I'm not doing the Jesus thing today. You know, it's like, what? I mean, still, people have to receive the information and...
Yes.
And that's the whole Hebrews thing. You're not even listening. You know, you have no ears. You know, you're not... Is that it?
It could be. Or... I mean, sometimes you need to change the dynamic of the situation. Sometimes... I mean, Jesus had a huge crowd of people who came to him because they were hungry. He had just fed 5,000 people. They came to him the next day, and Jesus said he preached his hardest sermon because he knew it was going to drive them away.
Yeah.
And so he did, and by the end of it, he had like 12 guys left. And he knew, these are 12 guys I can work with.
Yeah.
And so he got rid of the crowd. He didn't just get over the crowd. He got rid of the crowd.
And but then ultimately got him back later.
Yeah.
After the resurrection.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, so it wasn't like, he was doing something different than us. Mm-hmm. He was laying a foundation for the entire church.
I don't know that that's entirely different, though, right? Because, like, the point is that you've refined it to the extent of, to set the right base. Like, the people who otherwise would be leading this church, like, where everything was refined out, they at least got it to know that they couldn't go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it was them, through them, through which the base of things actually regrew back correctly, as opposed to trying to wrangle the crowd that was at times fickle and seeking different things.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes the refinement, like the people who hang around through the hard word are the people who actually had a desire to soak it in and then have the ability to adequately demonstrate as they go and make disciples. Whereas I suppose if you the people would have hung around and they otherwise weren't chased away but otherwise didn't grab it, all they're going to produce is the same level of understanding that made them stay but not really commit.
Jumping forward,
yep.
Day of Pentecost, suddenly there's 3,000 people. It wasn't those 11 guys left that, like, were doing the one-on-one discipleship. I mean, there was the preaching, teaching day-to-day in the temple courts. It was the stuff we do, the teaching, the groups,
right.
I don't know, that example is a bit of a, that's a false example, right? Because, like, that is a, that was all at once. Dude preaches 3,000, God adds to their number.
Well, yeah, and within, you know,
there's no small groups in there, Dan. You oversold that.
What I'm saying is that, you know, it wasn't like, what was the process?
That's kind of a tough comparison, right? Because, like, that was a direct situation. Peter preaches long times. People come to God. Like, there ain't no small groups in there, Dan. There are no cafe. Like,
I
that's just
I
one guy talking about Jesus.
But somehow they were being discipled. They were the original 12 disciples. So it's like they... Something happened. I mean, somehow they were discipling people. That's a lot of people to disciple. They didn't each whittle it down to 12 again. So there was 144.
It was probably more than 12 at that point, because later on in
120
his ministry,
with the, in the room.
Jesus sent out like another 72 He was about to go into Judea. But he started small and with just these 12 guys again and kind of reset expectations and said, hey, let's move forward. And so realign that base, and then it grew into the 72 and then sent them out, but kind of put things back into right perspective. He was able to dispel some of their expectations about what the Messiah was going to be. Not all of them, because, I mean, the disciples still weren't expecting the resurrection and the execution part, but, you know, he was able to kind of regrow his base, starting small. Starting with a small, just very devoted group of people, and say, all right, we're going to keep this devotion thing going. And they did it. And so then you've got 72 people who are now devoted. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to pass that on to when 3,000 show up. It's like now you've got a lot more people who can lead a very devoted movement instead of just a political national identity thing.
Well, then you move forward from there, and you got the Apostle Paul jumps into the picture, and he runs over here and runs over there and spends a few months here, a couple of years there, you know, and then takes off and goes again. You know, he leaves two or three behind, whatever, to keep the discipling going. And I'm just thinking out loud, you know, it's like it just kept going. You know, they didn't stop. They didn't say, well, let's not reach anybody because, you know.
No, but I actually think those things were happening. Like you're talking about, like, things continue to expand, and it was a much broader scale than when Jesus started, but they're still happening in microcosms, right? Like, they're still in churches, and, like, Paul is still going places, appointing leaders, like, basically spending time with people, getting them on board, and then that spreads. Like, they're all
doing the same stuff we're doing. None of them were Paul. Mm-hmm. They're all little mini, you know, doing their own thing, their own personality, their own life,
Right, but I think the examples are always, though, like it's starting with like smaller pockets of devoted people that then have impacts with what's going on around them versus like suddenly big shifts in large groups of folks. Like, that doesn't seem to be the normative way that things are moving. Like, or that's by its definition not organic. That's not an organic way of something happening. Something like, it's not a natural output. It's something bigger that changed. And so the question is like, what is the nature of your inputs? Like, if they say, look at all the things that we're doing, are the things, the inputs to those things that we're doing, the right inputs, right? Like, if the examples you have, or if the things that you're teaching, or like the scope isn't right, if the people that are reproducing aren't disciples or aren't living that out integrated, then yeah, they're just going to produce things that they do, and it will be a reflection of that, as opposed to a reflection of the 12 committed that were then the 72 committed that were then the exponentially growing committed. So it's really a question of your inputs, both from a leadership perspective and from like a base level perspective. Not just a, can we change what we're, it's not really, it's not as, it would be great if it was easy as change what we say, change minor things that we're doing, change our outlook. Like, it's really a question of inputs.
Yeah, if people are expecting to be a part of an organization where they get to sit in a pew, then that's exactly what they're going to live into, mm-hmm. is that expectation. But if their expectation is that everyone who is a follower of Jesus is going to reproduce this, then they're going to live into that.
Right. So, I mean, I guess I'm still trying, like, I'm jumping back and forth to, you know, New Testament and us, you know, like, okay, so what is that chasm? What is it that we're missing, or are we missing, or I mean, like I say, obviously we can always do things more efficiently and better and everything. Is it, but what is it that's not there?
From what you can see in the first century church in Acts, you've got a group of believers called specifically, you know, to not just learn. It's not just about the teaching and the learning in the first century church. It's that's not what's called out in Acts, and I think it's Acts 2 or 3. I can't remember specifically where there's a list of things that are happening in the church that is listed out. You know, the believers all share. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They shared stuff. And I mean, I'm very much paraphrasing here. They shared all their stuff. They went out into the cities and took care of the sick. I mean, it was not just a place where things were taught. The church was not just a place to learn. It was a living and growing organism that went and sustained people. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I'm not saying we're not doing that, but I think that as long as we are actively teaching and preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ and continually doing that, I think that that's a good basis and that's a good thing that we're doing. And if we're doing that right, which I think we are, don't change that. I don't think we need to put any flair onto that. I don't think we need to start trying to come up with some new exhaustive teaching plan or anything like that.
We're not, maybe it's just the active follower as opposed to just a follower.
Right.
Have a follower. Active follower.
When you get someone to switch from I show up to church to get something to I show up to church to give something, that is when you will start seeing a big shift in the paradigm of people.
When I wake up in the morning to give something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like it when people switch from receiving from the church to giving in the church to giving to people and seeing the church not just an event that shows up on Sunday mornings or on Wednesday evenings or whatever you want to call it, what day of the week
I
it
am
is,
the church at work,
not
I
just
am the
an event.
In the neighborhood.
They are part of a living and breathing organism that is the bride of Christ that is not just called to teach. Yes, that's a big deal, but Jesus didn't just say go and teach people how to be a disciple. It was show them. He showed them actively in life what that means. And a class is not just the only thing we can do.
Well, I mean, I guess what I would say then is I would agree with that, but would add to it that like even the teaching is shallow if it's not otherwise backed by that, right? Like
right.
The truth is that the force of the things that you teach, the things that you demonstrate, the life that you are trying to live, if you follow me as I follow Christ. If you're not following Christ, then them following you isn't going to help.
Right.
And so, like, that's really the question is, do you have committed Christ followers that are otherwise making disciples? Because, like, people that are, like, part-time following Christ or casually following Christ aren't really following Christ at all. And then their disciples will do those same things.
Right.
Like, that's what disciple is, the people that are following you. And so, like, and that's where the question, I think, it comes into, like, we're talking about the refinement of who you're dealing with, is it matters where your inputs are, because if you are not following Christ, it is only by some sort of, by miracles of Jesus that you're producing people that do. And I don't mean, like, infallibly following Christ. I mean, you are pursuing, even in your failures, are following Christ. And so, but it's just more expansive. We've accepted belief in Christ, even a serious theological understanding or attempt to believe and defense of what we think about Jesus as a rightful excuse or as a alternative to actually following Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that we look and we say, what else can I do? And generally the answer is do anything. We don't do anything. We've just kind of settled for a definition of what it looks like to follow Jesus. And that's the hard word. That's the refinement out down to 12 is like, hey, we're not following Jesus. Like, we've accepted the wrong understanding of what it is to follow Christ, and as we start to understand that, and people passionately follow Jesus, and they take people with them, that is when things happen naturally. You cannot stop that from growing, but I think what we're running into is we've accepted a wrong understanding of what it is to follow Jesus, and then we wonder why your mechanisms in our churches produce people that aren't wowing us or like doing things that otherwise are showing up in the Bible. When it's like, well, either God's not moving or we're not following. And I feel like number two is the rightful option. And so I actually think it's more of a, as a community, are we taking following Jesus? Are we actually understanding what that is? And that's a teaching item. What does that mean? And do we rightfully react to that? And then as those people interact with others, whether they're teach, whether it's their day-to-day things, whether it's interacting in community stuff or just regular relationships, that I think we'll produce other followers of Jesus, and that's Paul. Follow me as I follow Christ. That's Paul, and I actually think that's generally the answer. It's not a It's not a program tweak. It's not a offer something else. It's like, are your inputs into whatever it is that you're doing using that mechanism well? And if we're not passionately following Christ in whatever those things are, they will never produce the thing that we expect them to produce. That is a long podcast, boys. We're gonna have
to... I was going to say, we've got quite a bit of a podcast.
God bless you, Pete.
We appreciate you,
make
Pete.
Disciples.
All right. Hey, you've been listening to Live from the Path. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Thanks to Bob Eisenhower with the Eisenhower team. Westfield Veterinary Hospital, westfieldvethospital.com. Yeah, we're going to let you go. Be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. Thanks for listening to Live from the Path.